leaving any contact details. They traced the call, but it was to a public phone box in Cork City. They waited for Fiona to call for 8 days, but she didn't. Now they had a mystery man seen by a mystery woman, so they decided to launch a public appeal for her to come forward. They reached out to the producers of a national television show, Crimeline.
The brutal murder of Madame Sophie Toscan du Plantier shortly before Christmas Day has shocked the public and struck fear into the quiet community of West Cork. The body of the 39...
One in four people across Ireland tuned in. The ratings were higher than the most popular TV soaps. In a drama reenactment, Sophie was played by an actress driving around West Cork, dressed in clothes similar to those Gardaí knew Sophie had been wearing. They showed CCTV footage of Sophie arriving at Cork Airport.
Here we can actually see Sophie walking through the arrivals gate. These are the last known pictures of Sophie. She's wearing her long blonde hair in a single plait, and she has a pale complexion and deep-set grey eyes. She was a petite woman of 5'1". On Friday, she was wearing a...
Hoping to jog viewers' memories, they ran through Sophie's movements that weekend, right up until her phone call to Daniel late on Sunday night.
At 10 to 11, Sophie phoned her husband in France. He returned her call at 11 o'clock. This was the last time her voice was to be heard by her husband. What happened over the intervening hours remains a mystery.
At the end of the show, Chief Superintendent Noel Smith appears, looking nervous in his uniform under the studio lights. Behind him, you can see a room full of guards taking calls and making notes. The Crimeline host feeds him a line.
Now, you particularly want to address yourself to somebody who attempted to contact you and then didn't come back to you again.
Well, we did have a contact, Marion, last week. A caller made a phone call to Bandon Garda Station. And that caller gave us certain information which we think could be critical in solving this murder.
He's talking about Fiona, the anonymous caller.
Now, we know that that caller intended to call back a few days later. That call has not been returned. And I'm making a direct appeal to that person tonight to ring me here.
Fiona's sighting was doubly important since it seemed to tally with another statement. The guards had spoken to a local guy who was out that night. He was leaving his friend's house, not far from Sophie's. He wasn't sure of the time, maybe around 1:45 or 2 a.m. He said that as he was getting into his car, he'd heard a howling coming from the direction of what he knew to be Alfie Lyons' place, Sophie's neighbour. He said he'd stood still for a moment, with his car door open, listening. He decided it must be an animal and drove home. But yes, he told the guards, in hindsight, it could have been a woman screaming. Guards put this down as a possible time of death. If Fiona's black-coated man was the killer, this timing gave him long enough to reach Kilfada Bridge by the time she drove past, between 3 and 4 a.m.
My direct appeal, indeed my heartfelt appeal, still holds, that person who phoned Bandon Garda Station would contact this program tonight, or would contact me via Bandon Garda Station.
Right.
I'm still making that request as urgently as I can possibly make it.
As Chief Superintendent Noel Smith spoke, calls were coming in from all over, mostly with tips that would lead nowhere. A man with a scarred face spotted 200 miles away on a bus. A scarf found in a stolen car in Dublin with a label that read Made in France. There was no call from Fiona that night, but she was watching. She called the next day, again from a phone box, and asked to speak to Smith. She made an appointment to meet him, then she called back to cancel. But this time, she made a mistake. She called from home, and the guards traced the call. It was a house just outside Skull. Smith called in a local guard and asked him to listen to a recording of the phone call. He recognized the voice.
Hello?
Fiona was Marie Farrell, the woman who had already told the guards about seeing a strange man, a man in a long black coat. Guards paid her a visit. She told them it was her who had been making the phone calls. She was using a fake name because she was out driving that night with a man who wasn't her husband. Marie gave a statement that the man she saw looking at Sophie in Skull, out hitchhiking and out on the road the night of the murder, was the same guy. A blow-in. The guard started dropping his name around West Cork. It stuck out for Len Liptick.
The only question that I can really remember them asking me is, after I thought all the questioning was finished, he says, "Sir, do you know Ian Bailey?"
Ian Bailey, the reporter who spent weeks covering the story.
And it was clearly a big story for West Cork, and I just happened to be here.
Ian Bailey, who took us out to the crime scene.
Anyway, I'm just showing you this, so we don't want to be hanging around here.
Ian Bailey, who happened to have a long black coat.
Well, they seem to put an awful lot of emphasis on the fact that I had a black coat. You know, you need a good coat, don't you, for the winter climates here.
Have you any few words?
Ono Bolia is Ian Bailey. That's just the more Irish-sounding name Ian gave himself. It's what Florence knew to call him that morning of the Christmas swim. Her tape was seized by the guards. They wanted to take a look at this bit, where Ian appears in shot, wearing a long black coat and wide-brimmed black hat. The guards wanted to see how he was acting, just 2 days after the murder, and to check for any sign of injury. They asked Florence. She said she'd seen scratches on his hands, like little rivers. From the video, his hands are out of shot, so it's not clear either way.
You're a man of many words.
I have. The only comment I have to make is to show to my lawyer.
What about a poem?
And I put my trust in God.
What about a poem, Maureen? A limerick.
On the pier in Skull, as I stand here, gazing into your lens, looking over to the eyes of the thinking...
It's difficult to make out Ian's joke. Florence asks him for a few words. He replies, "The only comment I have to make is you can talk to my lawyer." And I put my trust in God.
West Cork is an Audible original production, written and produced by Jennifer Ford and Sam Bungie. Produced and sound designed by Kristen Muller, Alex Trajano, Robin Wise and Paul Schneider. Our theme music was composed by Shani Avaram. Our recording engineer is Sean Moher. West Cork is edited by Mike Olive. Our fact checker is Christine Baird. And Jesse Baker and Eric Newsom are the executive producers.
Two days before Christmas, 1996, while guards were scrambling, trying to make sense of the bloody scene at the end of Sophie's driveway, Ian Bailey was 3 miles east, happily unaware, he says, that this was the last ordinary day of his life.
There was a real festive buzz, and it actually felt like it was building up to be a very nice Christmas.
Ian was 39 years old. His partner Jules Thomas was 47. They lived just outside Skull in a cottage called The Prairie. They started late that morning. They'd been out at the pub the night before.
The original plan that day was we were going to go shopping and there was a turkey to be delivered to our friends.
At 1:40 p.m, Ian got a call. It was a journalist at the Cork Examiner newspaper telling him about reports of a body.
I said to Jules, "Well, look, there was only one car at that time." I said, "Well, look, I'll drive and you better bring your camera with you."
This is West Cork, an Audible original series. I'm Sam Bungie.
I'm Jennifer Ford, and this is episode 5, A Good Suspect.
And this is the route that I came up with. I was driving the car. Jules was in the passenger seat. We travelled along this road, and shortly there's a turning to the left.
That just here?
Yes.
Sophie's house is about a 10-minute drive from the Prairie Cottage. Not long after we first met him, Ian suggested he take us out there, retracing the route he and Jules took that day 20 years earlier. After the examiner's phone call, Ian says they stayed in to see if there was any mention of the murder on the news. There was a report, but it was thin on detail. There was a body, a woman. Ian says they might have said French. Ian was the first journalist to arrive at the crime scene. He and Jules drove slowly down the laneway, stopping only when they saw Garda cars. They got out. Jules took some photographs, and the guards walked towards them.
I started to walk down here and about where the telegraph pole is, thereabouts. I would have met two members of Garda Síochána and inquired of them, was there any statement forthcoming? And I was referred to the press office. I had no knowledge of the location of the body at that time, although it transpired it was outside and it was near the gate. You can see a five-bar gate there.
But so, okay, so you see a crime scene of like 10 people down there, people in overalls and stuff. You must have thought this is someone got murdered.
Well, I mean, I had what information, and I told you what information I had.
Right.
And it was obvious there was something going on here. I had no hard information, no names, no details.
Yeah.
And how long were you here for? How long did you
A matter of minutes.
But something about those few minutes didn't sit well with a local guard at the scene, Martin Malone. Earlier that year, an elderly man had fallen from a cliff, and Ian had come out to report on it for the local paper. Malone recalled that back on that day, Ian had been relaxed and chatty and wearing casual clothes. But at the crime scene of Sophie's murder, he seemed different. He was wearing a button-down shirt and a long, dark overcoat. The way the guard put it later in a statement was, it appeared to me as if he was acting at the scene of Sophie's murder. Acting, like he was just playing the part of a journalist. Ian makes out like the guard stonewalled him, but they say Ian only asked a few questions and then hurried from the scene, which they thought was strange. Malone also knew about Ian's reputation, as a heavy drinker, and there'd been a domestic incident with Jules that year. It all amounted to little more than a hunch, a gut feeling, but it meant that fewer than 5 hours after the body was discovered, Ian was already on the guard's radar. Ian spent Christmas in a frenzy at the typewriter. He wrote half a dozen stories about the murder over those first few days. The day after Christmas, he came up for air and left the cottage.
I'd gone into town early in the morning to get some messages, some briquettes and milk, and then I noticed I was being observed then by two officers. I knew one of them was a member of Garda Síochána. I didn't know the other. I guessed he was.
The two officers both filed statements about this incident. They were in the newsagents, a small corner shop in Skull, when Ian walked in. He drew attention to himself by barging his way to the counter. One of them wrote in the statement that Ian was unbelievably pale. He was unshaven and his hair was in disarray. To me, he was acting in a very unusual manner. Ian was wearing long sleeves, so the guards could only see as far as his wrists. But both guards were struck by what they saw on his hands.
Well, I mean, just to scratches on the back of my hands, I did have light markings. They weren't blood scratches. They were, they're hard to describe.
The guards followed Ian out of the shop. In their statements, they described this curious scene, watching Ian look back over his shoulder at them as he walked away, and then turn off the main street, only to poke his head back around the corner moments later, as if to check they were still watching.
And I went across the road and I noticed they came out and they were looking, they were scrutinizing me. And I walked down the street to a corner and I turned and I looked back up at the street and I saw the two detectives watching me. And I had the recollection of an Elvis Costello song in my mind going on, watching the detectives. But it was very strange, it was surreal. I knew I didn't have anything to do with this, you see. So I had nothing to fear. And yet, they had this strange scrutiny beginning.
2 days later, the same guards turned up at Ian and Jules' place to take a better look at the scratches. One officer wrote in a statement that they came right up to both elbows. He asked Ian about them. Ian explained that instead of buying a Christmas tree that year, he decided to cut one down himself.
What I was doing was I'd sawn off the top of a Christmas tree some 20-odd feet in the air, and I was pulling the top of that tree down through the remainder of the tree. So I was tugging it down, and as I was doing that, I got some light welts, I suppose you might call them. Now, when the guards came out here, I met the guard who noticed the scratches in the yard, and I had my sleeves rolled up. You'd have thought that if I had anything to do with this, and I knew that the scratches had come from that, I might have covered them up. I made no attempt to do that. Now, I know that's not a proof of not having done something, but at the same time...
You're not paranoid about your scratches, clearly.
No.
The guard also noticed a mark on Ian's forehead. Ian explained that was from a bloody battle with a turkey he killed for the Christmas table.
I got a tiny little hairline, a scratch from one of the claws of the turkey, which was then blown in, up out of all proportion into a deep wound on my face, which was never the case.
The guards believed Ian that he had cut down the tree and killed the turkeys. They spoke to a butcher who'd bought one of the turkeys, as well as a local guy who'd passed by the house just as Ian was hauling the freshly cut tree up the road. But they seemed to doubt that this was how Ian had got the scratches they were now so curious about. And they went to some lengths to try to support this. They sent a guard up the same tree to see if he got scratches like Ian's. He didn't. They brought down a forester with some 30 years' experience and asked him if someone could get multiple scratches from this tree. He told them it was highly unlikely. They spoke to people Ian had been out with on the Sunday night, after Ian had cut down the tree and killed the turkeys, but before Sophie was murdered. None of them remembered any scratches. But no one took photos. The guards later drew sketches of the scratches, from memory. One of them would concede that in hindsight, it would have been a good idea to have made a photographic record. Without knowing exactly what kind of injuries we're talking about, deep cuts or light scratches, it's impossible to really judge whether they're likely from a turkey or a tree or a late night chase through a hillside of briars.
That day the guards came to look at the scratches, they also felt out Ian's story. This was still just 5 days after Sophie's body was discovered. They asked Ian the same questions they were asking everybody. They had a checklist. Questions about Sophie. Did he know the deceased? Ian had a nuanced answer. He didn't know her, but he'd seen her once, from a distance, back when he was doing work on her neighbor's garden about 18 months earlier. But did he know her habits and haunts, anything about her movements from that weekend? He had no idea she was even in town that weekend, didn't know the woman. Where was he on the night of the murder? Sophie was killed sometime between 11 p.m. Sunday night, when she made that last phone call to her husband Daniel, and 10 a.m. Monday, when her neighbor Shirley drove past the body. Ian had an alibi for this entire period. That Sunday night, he and Jules had gone into Skull to the pub, and after closing time, around midnight, they'd driven home together. The guards asked which route they took home. He told them the back way, via a place called Hunt's Hill, which is a lookout point. When they got home, they had one more drink and went to bed together, and Ian said that's where they both stayed all night. So Ian was with Jules over the entire crucial period until around 10 the next morning, when he slipped out of bed to make her coffee.
The guards broadened it out. They wanted to know in detail what Ian had been up to for the entire weekend. Did he go to mass, shops, anything, no matter how trivial? At this point, they were still trying to build a picture of Sophie's final weekend. And soon, they would have another timeline to cross-check Ian's story against. Marie Farrell, the Skull shopkeeper, and her sightings of a man in a long black coat. Ian gave them a rundown. He talked about cutting down the Christmas tree, killing the turkeys, doing some gardening, another pub trip with Jules.
We'd cooperated with them fully. We'd filled in questionnaires to do with where movements and times over Christmas. I think that they suggested that we might have been inaccurate with one or two points, but it was a very busy period.
Ian was inaccurate on one or two points. For example, Ian forgot what he'd done on the Saturday night. Now, to be clear, this is about Saturday night, the night before the night of the murder. So, in a way, who cares, right? Ian told the guards he'd gone home with Jules as usual after a night in the pub in Skull, but actually he got that wrong. He'd stayed out on the Saturday and ended up sleeping on the sofa of a friend, Mark Murphy. But it was interesting to the guards because of the timeline Marie Farrell had given them. At this point, she'd only told the guards about two sightings of the man in the long black coat. First, she saw the man on Saturday afternoon, standing across the road from her shop when Sophie was inside. Then, early the next morning, when she passed him hitchhiking on the road out of town. Marie passed the man when she was driving up to Cork City, and that spot where she passed him happened to be right by Murphy's house, where the guards had found out Ian had spent the night. The guards were trying to join the dots. They spoke to the Murphys. They learned that a few of them had gone back to their place after the pub and stayed up drinking. When they finally called it at night, Ian had put his coat on and left, said he was going home, but a few minutes later he came back and asked to crash on the sofa. No one was sure exactly when this had been. At first the Murphys said 4 a.m, but there was a guy upstairs who had work the next day and was trying to sleep. He said it was more like 6. Marie Farrell had told the guards that she thought she drove past at about 7.
Well, I certainly didn't go and try and hitch. I left the house for a few moments and then went back.
Was it your intention to hitch?
I don't know. I planned to walk? But the point is that I stayed at the Murphy's house.
Ian didn't know anything about Marie Farrell's sightings at this point. For him to have deliberately misled the guards about going to the Murphy's house, he'd have to have been worried about things he simply couldn't have even known about. So it isn't so curious for us that he got this wrong. But as is so often the case with Ian, it's what he did about the mistake that's so strange.
I went down to the station and I said, I remember now, I spent the Saturday night. I just want to let you know that.
But Ian didn't go straight to the station to let them know that. First, he went back to the Murphy's house to speak to them. He'd heard the guards had already been there and wanted to find out what they talked about.
Well, I just thought, I was wondering, because of what was going on, I was making inquiries about their inquiries, if that makes sense.
That second visit, as the Murphys would later describe to the guards, Ian seemed agitated and in a hurry, sort of hopping on his feet while Jules waited in the car.
I was just curious as to the lines of inquiry they were making.
What was your worry?
Well, I think probably at this stage I was increasingly becoming aware of the fact that this would be during January, I guess, of 1997, that I was hearing these stories that I was somehow supposed to be responsible for the crime. And from the tone of the interviews that we'd been getting and visits from the guards, I was becoming, increasingly suspicious that they were trying to put me in the frame.
Despite checking up on the guards, Ian insists he wasn't too concerned about what they were up to.
You don't particularly worry, because you have nothing to hide.
I mean, I'd probably worry anyway. We have perhaps different constitutions or something. But it would worry me a lot, I think. But anyway, you weren't worried.
Well, no, I mean, I was aware of, and I had a sort of growing feelings. I wouldn't put it any more than that.
Growing feelings that the guards now had a short list of suspects, down to 6, and that he was on that list.
It was just something that occurred to me. And as it turned out, it was probably correct. And at the same time I was reporting on the case, I was finding it very difficult to get information from members of Ngata Shiakana. When I was approaching them, I spoke to Tumi on a number of occasions. And all the time, you're looking to try and come up with an angle that nobody else has come up with, to keep the story alive.
Some new bit of information.
Yes.
And that's the curious thing. Even though it was becoming clear to him that he was part of the story now, Ian didn't stop reporting on it. He'd been a reporter in the UK, but hadn't worked much since coming to Ireland. Now he was working every day and trying his best to get established. He was even going by Owen instead of Ian, because maybe it would help if his byline sounded more Irish.
I think there was people hadn't heard my name that much. I was relatively unknown as a journalist, and then all of a sudden they're seeing stories by Owen Bailey.
Ian happened to live just a few miles from the biggest story in the country, and he wanted to hold on to it. He talked about struggling to get information out of the guards to write about, But as a suspect, he was now on the inside of an investigation he'd been stuck on the outside of as a reporter. And he turned it all into front-page news. He reported that the guards were taking footwear from locals to compare with prints at the scene. He reported that guards were investigating loose strands of hair found on the body of the victim and trying to match them against samples from locals. He didn't declare to his editors or readers how he was getting this information. He knew because during visit after visit, the guards took fingerprints, hair samples, several pairs of boots from Jules and him. Ian also became a fixer for national and international journalists coming to West Cork to cover the story.
So I was fulfilling a number of roles. I wasn't necessarily writing stories for them, but I was channeling them to information.
He wasn't notified about official press conferences that guards were regularly holding on the case. So he began holding his own. He'd invite journalists and detectives to meet in his sitting room to discuss news about the case. And twice the detectives came. Who knows what was on their minds? But the last time these detectives had been at the house, they'd been taking Ian's fingerprints. Now, Ian was taking them all through his theory of a French connection, that Sophie's husband Daniel was involved in her death. He told the guards that Daniel Toscan de Plantier had money troubles, that his recent films were box office disasters. He spoke darkly of connections with the Corsican mafia. Money owed, a deal gone bad. Ian knew the guards had been to Paris, but the rumour was they'd hit red tape and hadn't got far beyond the hotel.
The team of guards went over there. What did they do? They sat around, they drank some coffee, they ate some croissants, and they went to some nice restaurants. And that was basically the limit of their investigation.
It seems that the guards began to develop a theory about this behaviour. They figured maybe Ian didn't really think the killer came from France. He just wanted other people to think that.
That was an allegation, I think, that was suggested by certain elements within the guards that I was trying to steer the attention of focus away from myself, when in fact I had nothing to do with it, and all I was doing was doing my job.
As the investigation wore on, Ian didn't stop writing, but he did request that the papers remove his byline from several articles. He'd later explain in court that this was sometimes because he was one of several contributors. In another case, he said it was to avoid community repercussions over such a sensitive story. The result is, it's difficult to know exactly which information was coming from Ian. But we know Ian was spending a lot of time with a leading French journalist who was filling him in on what she knew about the French side of the investigation. One article he says he contributed to in the Daily Star on January 20th, 1997, read in part, "While sources in France seem overly keen to point the finger of blame at a local on the Mizen Peninsula, the belief among people in West Cork is that there's definitely a French connection." One detective in particular was very interested in what Ian was writing.
Yeah, well, the first time I met Ian Bailey, there was some article that he had written, and I wasn't very clear about it. And I went down to the house and he was expecting me because I'd given him advance notice.
Detective Dermot Dwyer retired about 15 years ago. People who knew him back then described him as a sort of West Cork Columbo. Maybe it's because of his style, overcoat, shirt and tie, smoking a pipe. Or maybe it was his disarming manner. Detective Dwyer is originally from Kerry, one county over from Cork, where some people say the locals have a reputation for knowing more than they let on. When we first met him, by appointment in a Cork City hotel lobby, he fed us a Columbo-style line. "Us Kerry men," he told us, "we're not too smart, but we're not too stupid either." Ian had been on Detective Dwyer's radar for weeks. He'd been following everything at the guards' nightly conferences and been reading Ian's reporting, but he'd yet to meet him. A month into the investigation, Detective Dwyer called around to the prairie one Friday afternoon.
"Well, always, if you're investigating anything, it's very important to understand the other guy and what way he thinks and what's important to him. And, you know, that's part of being any policeman doing his job."
But he was the lead detective. I'd seen Minion detectives previously. I think Culligan and Harrington actually delivered him and introduced him outside, and he came in and they went off.
And he invited me in and he sat down. He was very pleasant and very inviting and hospitable. sit down, and I sat down, and he made coffee for me, very good coffee, and his wife was obviously a good baker, and he gave me a couple of mince pies, I think they were. They were beautiful, as a matter of fact.
They talked about the case as if there were just a couple of guys shooting the breeds. Dwyer says Ian told him it wasn't likely they were looking for a local person. Ian thought he would have cracked under the pressure by now. But Dwyer wasn't so sure.
He's quite a good talker, and he's kind of intelligent in ways. And we discussed the murder from A to Z, and I asked him his views on it, and I had my own views on it, and I had a very broad mind.
I actually was taken in by him. I mean, I was suspicious of him, but I was also taken in by him, because I thought he seemed like quite an affable sort of guy. I didn't realise he was actually a fucking psychopath.
He kept on intimating that he suspected I knew more about this murder than I was acknowledging.
Ian didn't know that 3 days before Dwyer's visit, the guards had made a break in the case, and it looked bad for Ian. They now knew that Marie Farrell was the mysterious Fiona, the woman who called under a fake name about a sighting on the night of the murder. The guards had put that together with Marie's other two sightings of a man in a long black coat over the weekend. And Marie told them that this man was Ian.
That you saw him around 3 o'clock, and that he looked out of his mind, looking up at the sky and shaking, and he didn't know where he was.
Well, I mean, I told him, I said, that's ridiculous. The whole thing was a fiction.
He says he'd been in bed the night of the murder. Dwyer denies it, but Ian says before leaving, the detective told him there was just one more thing.
And he asked me, did I play poker? I mean, I don't play poker, but I know what poker's about, and poker is about bluff.
Dwyer left his card, and first thing Monday morning, he got a phone call.
I was obviously doing a lot of thinking about him too, and out of nowhere, he rings me in the morning around 9 o'clock and asked me to meet him. I thought it was quite obvious I was in his mind too.
They met and had coffee in a nearby village. And then 2 days later, Ian called him again.
You know, I'm working on the story. You know, I'm the lead journalist on it.
We had a cup of coffee again, and we were chatting. And he started talking about how busy he was. He had journalists to meet, and he was meeting journalists from Paris and so on and so forth. He was on a high.
It might seem quite bizarre at this particular point that here I am. I'm reporting on the crime, and I'm trying to come up with angles. And, you know, at the same time, I'm being increasingly focused on as the culprit.
I mean, it seems crazy. It seems crazy to me.
Well, the whole thing is crazy, actually, when you look at it.
But you seemed, I don't know what's going on, are you in total denial at that point?
How total denial of what?
Because the detective's just told you that he's going to put you at Kilfreda Bridge, and then you think he's going to sit down and give you things to write about the incident.
Well, it might sound a bit crazy, and it might well have been. But it happened.
Were you hoping?
I would have been hoping that I might have got some information from him. I don't know, I can't recall.
Information about what they thought they had on you?
Or? Well, information generally about the way the inquiry was going.
But you knew it was going
I had a sort of sense that might have been happening, but I didn't absolutely know. I mean, I can understand you saying it sounds a little bit crazy, and it probably was, and it may have been a bit. I may well have been ill-advised myself to do that, but it's something that I did.
Word got out in West Cork that Ian was a suspect. A few days after meeting Detective Dwyer, Ian gave a neighbour, 14-year-old Malachy Reid, a lift home from Skull. In the car, he asked Ian how everything was going, just general chit-chat. He said Ian told him, everything was fine until I went up there with a rock and bashed her fucking brains in. Ian says he didn't quite say it that way, and that whatever he said, he meant it sarcastically. But it wasn't the right crowd for dark humour. The boy was freaked out and told the guards, who also took it at face value. The detail about the rock jumped out at the guards. Was Ian betraying an inside knowledge of the crime? It was something they were already considering. His first reports in the Sunday Tribune newspaper days after the murder featured rich detail. The path Sophie had been pursued across the property. The injuries to the back of her head. Ian said he was just picking up on what had already been widely circulated in West Cork or in other articles. Around this time, Ian got a call from a furious editor at the Sunday Tribune. The paper had heard that Ian might be a suspect and called to confront him. Again, Ian reached for sarcasm.
I cracked some dark humour joke, which I regret, that, I did this because I needed a story.
The editor would later say in court that Ian had told her, "It was me, I did it, I killed her, I did it to resurrect my career." She said she was flabbergasted, she didn't know what to think.
The Tribune had a situation and had to do something. That's where photojournalist Billy McGill came in. Billy hadn't met Ian, but before the murder they'd been in contact about working together on stories. Billy lived nearby and he knew the terrain. He was speaking to an editor at the Tribune one day, and she told him how worried they were about Ian's coverage of the murder.
She said he's on every few hours with updates on this murder, and we're all getting a little paranoid here about it. He seemed to be becoming quite obsessed.
Billy had a plan. Get Ian to show him around to some of the key places in the murder case, and this would allow him some time to suss Ian out. They met in a pub in Skull. As soon as he walked in, Billy says he spotted two plainclothes detectives eyeing Ian up from the other side of the bar. Billy needed to spend some time alone with Ian, so he suggested they take his car. Just to explain here, Billy's the type of guy who knows how to clock a plainclothes detective. He's also the type of guy who owns three cars and drives all of them fast.
Yeah. I have what's called a D license, very few of them in this country. I can drive.
Billy says they quickly lost the detectives and settled into an afternoon tour of West Cork. They visited a guy who early on was considered a suspect, and they drove to the water near Sophie's house where teams had been searching for evidence. And over the day, Billy wondered about Ian. He figured if Ian knew he was being looked at as a possible suspect, he should be at home, keeping his head down, not out with a fellow journalist touring the investigation hotspots.
I wasn't there to advise him to tell him that he was getting too close to the flame or anything else, but as the afternoon unwound, I would come to the conclusion, these guys are going to have a lot of pressure in getting somebody quickly, and mate, you shouldn't be where you're at this point in time, because the whole nation is watching this. I genuinely felt that he had to be in the centre of this, that he liked it, he liked the attention. When you play with fire, you've got to be a good juggler.
Towards the end of the day, Ian even directed Billy out to Sophie's house.
We had now arrived at what we would say the scene where the body had been found. Just remember something that was interesting now.
Billy told us when they got to the gate, Ian insisted they get out the car and leave all the camera equipment behind. He made as if to pat Billy down and asked if he was wired up with a recording device. Ian had them move away from the car down to the gate. Then, Billy says, Ian confronted him about what exactly his intentions were that day.
When there's only two people, and when you stare into the darkness of each other's eyes, and when he asks you the question, "Do you think I killed her?" You count to 10. You count to 10 again. You give him this answer. From what I have read, from what I have seen, I think you did murder her.
Billy didn't know what the guards had on Ian. He had no inside knowledge. But he was willing to believe the worst of him, because he found his behavior so strange. So there, standing on the spot where Sophie's body was found, Billy told Ian that yes, at that moment, he thought Ian did murder her. 4 days later, Monday, February the 10th, 1997, Ian was arrested for murder.
The small country roadway beside where Owen Bailey lives was blocked with traffic today as the media gathered to hear his story. Mr. Bailey was questioned in Bandon Garda station in connection with the murder of Madame Sophie Tuscan Duplantier.
Well, for 12 hours I was subjected to a barrage of questioning from different officers, between 10 to a dozen officers. There was one common theme that went on throughout this, that they knew that I was the killer. They were convinced.
Did you know Sophie Tuscan Duplantier?
I didn't know her, inasmuch that I'd never met her, but I had seen her once and she was pointed out to me.
But you're saying to me here, you didn't kill Sophie de Plantier, nor did you have any part in that.
I am saying to you that I didn't kill her, I had no knowledge of the killing, and I'm an innocent man.
West Cork is an Audible original production, written and produced by Jennifer Ford and Sam Bungie.
Produced and sound designed by Kristen Muller, Alex Trajano, Robin Wise and Paul Schneider.
Our theme music was composed by Shani Avaram.
Our recording engineer is Sean Moher.
West Cork is edited by Mike Olive.
Our fact checker is Christine Baird.
And Jesse Baker and Eric Newsom are the executive producers.
Hello, Ian. How are you doing?
Good evening. I'm okay.
So, how are things there? Any news?
Well, I mean, it's just a very pleasant evening.
Speaking with Ian became a regular part of our lives for a while. When we weren't in West Cork, Ian would update us on what he'd been up to. Like when he self-published a book of his poetry, a plan he'd been working on way back before the murder accusation put things like that on hold, before he became a household name in Ireland.
Enormous market in Skibbereen last. And I was selling my poetry for the first time. I had a few early editions, and I sold to quite a few interesting people, such as Jeremy Irons and Sinead Cusack, would you believe?
Do you think they recognised you?
Oh, did they? Do you... that's a silly question at this juncture.
Right.
Slightly silly. I mean, did I recognise them? Yes. Did they recognise me? Yes, of course. We're all sort of quite high-profile residents in West Cork.
Ian's been criticised over the years for courting attention, for embracing his high-profile status, even though it comes from being a murder suspect and not from being a movie star.
Anyway, I was thinking about your project the other night, maybe actually...
He was always thinking about our project. He'd have a new person we should speak to, an angle to pursue. He called it directing from the back seat. It was uncomfortable at times, wondering whether he understood that we wouldn't only tell the parts of the story he wanted us to. But sometimes it was easiest to just go with it.
I was going to ask you this. How do you think we should start it?
Well, I'd have to give that question some thought, but I could probably come up with an answer. Well, maybe, I don't know, maybe you started by talking to me.
This is West Cork, an Audible original series. I'm Jennifer Ford.
I'm Sam Bungie, and this is episode 6, The Englishman.
The moment he came through the door, I thought, yeah, he's got something about him.
John Hawkins was Ian's first boss back in the UK. John ran a local news agency and was working out of an attic office back then. He remembers clearly how Ian, still at school, had to stoop to get through the door.
He came in a big trench coat, so he would never have said this was an 18-year-old boy coming in through the door.
We'd always wondered why Ian even came to West Cork, to this place at the edge of Europe, where he didn't know anyone. One day we got a text out of the blue from Ian. saying we should speak to John. He wrote he'll give you the IB backstory, as in the Ian Bailey backstory. And he has a V good broadcast voice.
But he was very confident. He was big and brash and bold. He impressed me. I saw real potential there from the off.
A lot of people gripe about Ian in West Cork, but this is something we heard there too, that Ian could also be really charming. It's hard not having known him before he was accused of this horrendous crime, and not to have that colour our own view of him. Even still, you can imagine it. He's charismatic. Back in 1975, John had just started his business, and was looking for someone with promise to train up as a full-time reporter. Ian got the job, and John paid for courses where Ian learned things like shorthand and media law. He taught Ian to write in news style and sent him to the Gloucester courts to cover crime. He took Ian under his wing.
But Ian wasn't quite the diligent apprentice John was hoping for.
Within months questioning my view and my authority, my experience, I found him quite difficult to manage because he would decide for himself what he was going to do.
But some of the social aspects of the job began to distract Ian from the actual work. Back in those days, regional companies looking for favourable coverage would throw drinks parties and put on lunches out at Gloucester country clubs, sending invites out to all the local media. Ian was a fixture at these events, showing up at a moment's notice to hobnob and drain the free bar. It wasn't just Ian, all the young journalists loved going to these events. The only problem was Ian was meant to be out covering assignments.
He would do the job well when he did do the job. I just wanted him to apply himself. And I just felt that he'd just got too big for his boots.
One weekend, Ian was supposed to be out of town at an 8-week journalism course that John was paying for. Instead, he snuck into the office with some friends and threw a party. When John returned to the office on Monday morning, the place was trashed. There were empty beer cans everywhere, papers on the floor, and the scent of weed in the air.
I was absolutely appalled. I found it very hard to tolerate the idea of keeping him on after he would do something like that. Couldn't really understand quite how bad it was, you know, why I was making such a fuss.
John decided that his working relationship with Ian had run its course.
He actually told me that I made a big mistake, you know, that he was the best thing that ever happened to me. And the next thing I knew, he'd set up as a freelance himself, just up the road in Cheltenham, doing exactly the same kind of work that I'd taught him to do.
So the way John saw it, he had trained Ian up, and now Ian was setting himself up as the competition. Again, Ian doesn't see the big deal. He told us that he deliberately set up in a separate town, Cheltenham, so he wouldn't be taking any work from John. John says inevitably there was overlap. The falling out was so serious, there was a time when John's wife wouldn't even have Ian's name mentioned in the house. John thought it was funny that Ian had suggested we speak to him. But then it kind of made sense to him. That's just Ian. He could be a bit clueless.
I don't think the concept would come to his mind that he was actually making life difficult for somebody. And that doesn't surprise me that he would say that at all.
I don't think he ever realised the upset he caused.
This is Kay Reynolds, Ian's younger sister.
He's always a very confident air about him. Certainly always thought outside the box. And, I mean, I absolutely idolised my brother. He was just like my hero.
Kay told us about life growing up with Ian in Gloucester, a small city surrounded by countryside in southwest England. She spoke affectionately about their parents.
Northern working class, Dad worked on the market. He was a butcher and worked very hard. Mum stayed at home, looked after us and her mum. So there's tons of food around. Not a lot of money, but loads, always loads of food.
But Kay says there was tension at home.
And he's definitely, I'd say, I don't know, a bit different.
Ian did well at school. He had the marks to get into the prestigious Crip Boys Grammar School, but he was on the rugby team and fell into the drinking culture around the sport. Ian's parents weren't drinkers, and they weren't sure how to handle it.
You know, they didn't understand. I don't think they quite understood him. His behaviour seems so sort of out of character to the rest of our family.
Kay says she'd overhear her parents' worried conversations about Ian when he was out partying.
Just wondering where he was, or if he didn't come home. So I were overcompensated by being the good one, because I used to see that they'd be upset. and I wouldn't want to cause. So I never rebelled, and I resent, almost like resented Ian for that, in a way. You know, as I grew older, that I'd never had that. You know, I didn't want to upset them as well. Certainly think they were glad when he left home.
Years later, when the guards confiscated Ian's diaries from his home in West Cork, they found lots of entries about drinking, which took on an increasingly destructive role in Ian's life. He wrote, "My first experience of alcohol was drinking shandy with my father. My father, a butcher, a stout man, was never a drinker. I remember more than once he complained of a feeling of dizziness as he supped his lemonade and pale ale shandy cocktail. I've definitely not inherited his aversion. I've been making a fool of myself by drinking to excess."
After John let him go, Ian left his parents' place and moved to Cheltenham, an affluent town. He fell in with a group of young journalists who hung out at a local cafe and traded stories. Viv Hargreaves was in that group.
He was a, you know, sort of rising star amongst us. A focused go-getter, brilliant journalist who's got a really bright future ahead of him. Tall, dark and handsome, very, you know, sort of very charismatic. He'd even managed to sort of whip stories off me, which is unheard of, really.
George Henderson was another local journalist. He met Ian while covering court news.
6'4", quite a traumatic sort of eyes on him, deep voice, you know. And he came across as very sort of capable and very persuasive.
Ian managed to charm George so much he convinced him to quit his job as a staff reporter and go into business with him. The two of them worked well together. George is the main writer and Ian is the salesman. George says Ian was particularly good at getting the best price and placement for their stories. Then they got a big scoop. A juicy national story about a Cheltenham cab driver who turned out to be a British spy secretly working for the Russians. Ian and George were at the right place at the right time. Ian made contact with the investigative unit at the Sunday Times, back then the UK's paper of record, and worked with them as a local correspondent on the story. It was a huge success for a 22-year-old. He made the most money he'd ever make that year.
He was really set on sort of working up from his roots. His dad was a local butcher. He wanted to really make his mark. He was very keen to be a go-getter.
Flushed with success, he met a girl, another young reporter, Sarah Limbrick, and they married the next year. His new wife's parents owned property all over Cheltenham, and as a wedding gift, they gave Ian and Sarah a house. A grand old house with great beamed ceilings and a lake behind it. Viv said Ian and Sarah became a sort of Cheltenham power couple. Ian's sister Kay says he even changed the way he spoke.
I don't know whether he actually went to speech lessons or elocution lessons, but he certainly lost his northern accent deliberately in terms of wanting to be able to portray himself with a certain persona. Yeah, it was just part of what he is, you know, who he's becoming as a journalist. It was all to do with his work.
His friend George saw it as part of a complete transformation. He wanted to impress people. George remembers going to an upmarket wine bar one day, and rather than the customary beer, Ian ordered them a bottle of champagne.
You see, let's sit in the window, then people will see us drinking champagne. You know, I mean, all our friends got faults, haven't they? He just had a bit of an ego problem. He just liked to show off. Fine, that's Ian, you know. He wanted all the prizes. He wanted the cars, he wanted to get a big detached house. So he had all the trappings, but it wasn't actually his.
Things went wrong with the marriage, and that unfortunately was the sort of undoing of Ian here in this country.
One Christmas, George stayed at Ian and Sarah's. He learned they were sleeping in different parts of the house. They separated soon after.
I think he was genuinely heartbroken. And then he would get angry, and I kind of banging the steering wheel of the car. And why is she doing this to me?
During the divorce, Ian discovered that his name wasn't on the deeds to their house. He ended up walking away from the marriage with much less than he thought was fair. When the guards spoke to Sarah after the murder, she told them that Ian would punch the wall, turn over tables, or throw the typewriter across the room. And Ian admitted the separation had been acrimonious.
I think he was troubled in general and very angry because he could probably see his world falling apart and his relationship falling apart and everything he'd made. And I think you're very ambitious. This huge sense of failure and guilt and all that sort of business starts to creep in. And as soon as you've got those toxic things mixed with drink and other substances, you've got problems. I think when people ring you up with a boozy voice on desperate, you know that it's not a good thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's obviously, he was showing signs of cracking up.
Ian started spending less and less time at the office. Then his business partner George says he made a discovery about their affairs. Money Ian and George made on stories was meant to be shared equally, but George says when his paycheck bounced, he took a closer look at the accounts and realized that Ian had been skimming a little off the top. When we asked Ian about it, he said it's so long ago he doesn't remember the details, but that he has no memory of this. George says he didn't even have to formally break with Ian. It was a loose partnership with no legal ties, and Ian seemed to lose interest in work anyway. He wrote George out a check, and after that, he started disappearing on random holidays. One afternoon back in Gloucester, he stopped by Viv's house. She said he was in a giddy mood.
He'd been to Wales, I think, and he'd been to some beach and found this great big rock, and he was so impressed with it. He brought this rock in his boot to show us. He went out to the boots, he lifted the boot up and said, "Look at this fantastic rock. You know, you must see it." Yes, Ian, it's a really nice rock, but it was only a rock. And I thought, Ian, what's going on here? You know, what's happening here? And he was saying, "Oh, and I've got some really good cannabis." And then I sort of realised that he was sort of going off in a little bit of a tangent in his life. I think he'd probably agree with what I'm saying. And that's really the sort of last time that we saw him.
Ian was someone Viv liked. She told us funny stories about him at parties in fancy dress, and she admired him professionally. But in a few years, Ian had gone from an ambitious young man to this spaced-out dude with big shiny rocks in the back of his car. Viv and Ian lost touch after that. George saw less of him too. Ian sold his flat in Cheltenham and moved to London. In London, he tried to hook back up with those Sunday Times people who he'd met as a bright young reporter, when the contacts seemed to offer unlimited opportunity. He did work in the newsroom for a stint, and freelance for national newspapers, but none of these places offered Ian a full-time position. Ian would later say in court, "London, I hated. Nobody, you couldn't speak to anybody." Excerpts from his diaries from around this time were read out in court too. "I feel as though I've suffered an illness of confusion. What began has now ended, therefore I have a new beginning. I will not be able to rest easy for some time until all is done to free me of the shackles of materials and consumer society." Later he added, "I feel self-loathing, a hatred of myself. I must expunge these feelings."
I was becoming increasingly disillusioned with the way newspapers were going. And I decided I was going to come over to Ireland and seek a sort of different way of living.
It was the winter of 1991. Ian Bailey was 34 years old. He'd abandoned journalism and begun writing poetry. Sitting in St. Stephen's Green in Dublin one day, the home, as he wrote in his diary, of Joyce and Yeats, he wrote,
"There's an atmosphere of sedate style and comfortable living. The problem is that I have no home or base. At the same time, I have no money. I've always been an outsider."
That year, he'd been wandering through Ireland, picking up manual work where he could. He spent a few months on a farm, where his job was to ward crows off the crops with a shotgun. Then he drifted west, travelling alone until he reached Skull.
I can just remember thinking how wonderful a place it was. And I was struck by the friendliness of the people here. And I guess I fell in love with the place.
Ian got a job at a local